Call to order the Civil Law Committee hearing. First, we'll have Ms. Vaught note the roll. And we also have in front of us the minutes from the January 22nd Civil Law Committee meeting. Representative Burrell moves approval of those minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Minutes are approved as distributed. The next item on our agenda is the issue before the committee today. This is an informational hearing. We don't actually have a bill in front of the committee. The structure of the testimony today will center around the history and evolution of marriage law in the country and in the state. We have a number of professionals that will be testifying in front of us today. We will ask that they limit their comments to 15 minutes. That will allow for some time for questioning, and then our hearing will conclude by 11 a.m. For a matter of the record, Caroline Palmer submitted a written letter to the committee. She was not able to stay for the hearing, but I'd like to make note of that letter in the record, and it will be held with the committee minutes. The first person that will be addressing the committee today will be Dr. Charles Reed. Mr. Reed, if you'd step to the podium and state your name for the record, we would appreciate it.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Charles J. Reed, Jr., and I teach at the University of St. Thomas School of Law.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee and members. There is written testimony provided by Dr. Reed in your packets. If you'd continue.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I should begin by saying my testimony represents my professional knowledge and opinion as a professor of law, a trained historian. It is not intended to represent the views of my employer or any other organization or person. The founders of the American legal tradition, jurists like Chancellor James Kent and Joseph Story, had a strong sense of the purposes which marriage was to serve in the legal systems of a new nation. Their sense of purpose was derived ultimately from Christian foundations of the common law, which were traceable to the Church's canon law, which governed marital relations in medieval and early modern England.
Okay. Can you all hear me? The canon law of the Middle Ages built its entire structure of marriage law on three pillars. The three goods of marriage, to use the term the canons themselves would have used. These goods were ultimately derived from St. Augustine, the 5th century North African theologian and doctor of the church. Marriage, St. Augustine argued, was grounded ultimately in the natural sociability of male and female. The first and most important manifestation of this sociability was found in the sexual joining of male and female. This joining, however, was to be governed by certain foundational rules grounded in the natural law. Marriage was to serve three great goods: procreation, the generation of the next generation; fidelity, understood as loyalty and love between the spouses; and specifically in Christian marriage, is a sacramental bond that mirrored the bond between Christ and his church, and that could be broken by no earthly power. These three basic goods provided the philosophical foundation for the marriage law of the Middle Ages. Gratian, the 12th century canonist and the founder of systematic canon law, put these Augustinian principles into a legal framework. Procreation, fidelity, loyalty, sacramental unity became enforceable ideals. These ideals became the foundation for all subsequent writing about marriage in the Middle Ages. These ideals became as well the foundation of the English common law tradition. The common law itself was divided between, the English law was divided jurisdictionally between the common law, which had jurisdiction over common law felonies, murder, mayhem, and arson, and jurisdiction over the landed estates of England. Common law, however, did not enjoy a monopoly of jurisdiction. Within England, the ecclesiastical courts exercised a great deal of jurisdictional authority, and this included jurisdiction over matters that we would take today as domestic relations law: marriage, the family, child support, separation, these sorts of issues were handled by the ecclesiastical courts with real coercive jurisdiction. The Protestant Reformation broke out in 1517. The nations of the European continent that turned to Protestantism, Germany, the Netherlands, the Scandinavian lands, abolished ecclesiastical jurisdiction over marriage. Jurisdiction over marriage in those lands passed into the hands of the state. England, however, represents the middle ground between the Protestant reformers of the continent and the old legal forms of the Catholic Church. The English rejected the Catholic belief that marriage was a sacrament, but they nevertheless argued that it constituted a holy estate which existed to serve the goods of the parties and the procreation and education of children. The structure of the Anglican canon law continued to be shaped by the Augustinian goods of marriage. Procreation, fidelity, lifelong unity, at least absent some serious marital misconduct, remained the essential elements of marriage, according to the Anglican writers. Why should we be concerned here in the United States with what Anglican canon lawyers thought about marriage three or so centuries ago? Because early American lawyers borrowed these Anglican ideals and made them a part of the fabric of American law. In this way, the basic Augustinian framework came to shape American law. One can consider some of the early American evidence more closely. Chancellor Kent borrowed heavily from the canon law in articulating his own understanding of marriage. He recognized that New York was not England, that New York lacked ecclesiastical courts that gave the canon law direct force in the England of his day. But as Kent put it in his opinion in Whiteman versus Whiteman, are the principles of natural law and of Christian duty to be left unheeded and inoperative because we have no ecclesiastical courts recognized by law charged with the cognizance of matrimonial matters? Kent concluded that the doctrine developed by the English ecclesiastical court should continue to shape the reasoning of the American judiciary. Nor was Kent alone in this view. The New York Chancery Court in 1836 declared that it would follow ecclesiastical law regarding proper procedure in nullity cases. Indeed, the canon law continued to influence American law throughout the 19th century. I mentioned in my testimony the Nevada Supreme Court, which declared in 1882, the law of marriage and divorce is administered by the ecclesiastical courts, is a part of the common law of this country, except as it has been altered by statute. The purposes and structure of the Anglican canon law of marriage were also retained by the American lawyers. One can see this in legal commentary throughout the 19th century. I mentioned Chancellor Kent, who asserts that the primary and most important of the domestic relations is that of husband and wife. It has its foundation in nature and is the only lawful relation by which Providence has permitted the continuance of the human race. In every age, it has had a propitious influence on the moral improvement and happiness of mankind. It is one of the chief foundations of social order. We may justly place to the credit of marriage a great share of the blessings which flow from refinement of manners, the education of children, the sense of justice, and the cultivation of the liberal arts. Joseph Story, Supreme Court Justice and believing Christian, added, "Marriage is treated by all civilized nations as a peculiar and favored contract. It is, in its origin, a contract of natural law. It may exist between two individuals of different sexes, although no third person exists in the world, as happened in the case of the common ancestors of mankind. It is the parent, not the child, of society." Other commentators make much the same point. I mentioned Leonard Shelford in the testimony. I'll also mention Joel Prentice Bishop, citizen of Massachusetts, and one of the great commentators on the American law of the 19th century. "Evils numberless, extending to the demoralization of society itself, would follow the abandonment of marriage as a permanent status and permitting it to be the subject of experimental and temporary arrangements and fleeting partnerships. Wisely, therefore, the law holds marriage to be a union for life. It is so also so in the common sentiments of mankind and in the teachings of religion." As recently as 1921, James Schuller could write in an important treatise on the American domestic relations law, When man unites with woman, both were brought under certain restraints for their mutual well-being. The propagation of offspring afforded the only means whereby society could hope to grow into a permanent and compact system. Hence, the sexual cravings of nature were speedily brought under wholesome regulations, as otherwise the human race must have perished in the cradle. Natural law, or the teachings of a divine providence, supplied these regulations. The common law, the court decisions of the American judiciary, echo these sentiments. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court wrote in 1847, "The great end of matrimony is not the comfort and convenience of the immediate parties, though these are necessarily embarked in it, but the procreation of a progeny. The paramount purpose of marriage is the procreation and protection of legitimate children, the institution of families, and the creation of natural relations among mankind, from which proceed all the civilization, virtue, and happiness to be found in the world." The Indiana Court of Appeals added 50 years later, "The marriage relation creates the homes of the land, and it alone can effectively secure the care, nurture, and education of children. It is, therefore, one of the chief foundations upon which rests the civilization, the prosperity, the stability, the good order and happiness of society. The state, therefore, encourages marriage, and after the marriage relation is entered into, is interested in maintaining it unbroken." Now, what has happened in recent decades? What we have seen is a discarding of these definitions, replaced by a kind of agnosticism regarding the purposes of marriage. An important, inadvertent, but important step in these recent developments was taken in the case of Turner versus Safley, decided in 1987. In Turner, the Supreme Court unanimously struck down Missouri prison regulations. You had both Antonin Scalia and William Brennan concurring in this. That had the effect of prohibiting most marriages between inmates and those outside the prison system. Writing for the entire court, Justice O'Connor recognized that marriage, as recognized by civil society today, comprises many elements. It serves not only procreative purposes, but emotional and spiritual purposes as well. Furthermore, Justice O'Connor added, marital status carries with it many civil benefits. Among these benefits, O'Connor numbered Social Security, property rights, and inheritance rights. What has happened in the 17 years since Turner was decided has been an effort by contemporary legal commentators to build a case for same-sex marriage and the various incidents of marriage distinguished in O'Connor's opinion. In essence, courts and commentators have now removed O'Connor's list of marital goods from the penological context and relied upon them to argue against the traditional linkage between marriage and heterosexual reproduction. In particular, it has been argued that the benefits conferred by the state on married persons should become the touchstone of analyzing the question, what constitutes marriage? This argument turns the older vision of marriage on its head. Formerly, it was understood that the state conferred benefits on married persons because of the vital roles played by married persons in the health, well-being, and continued survival of society. Now it seems that marriage is no longer understood to serve these larger social goods. Now the benefits themselves have become the heart of what marriage is all about. This shift is seen especially clearly in recent case law on the subject of same-sex marriage. Bear versus Lewin, decided in 1993, sought to require Hawaii to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Unlike older case law, Bear began its analysis of the marital relationship from a statist premise. It was not natural law, but the state that brought marriage into being. The power to regulate marriage is a sovereign function reserved exclusively to the respective states. By its very nature, the power to regulate the marriage relation includes the power to determine the requisites of a valid marriage contract and to control the qualifications of the contracting parties and the forms and procedures necessary to solemnize the marriage, the duties and obligations it creates, its effects upon property and other rights, and the grounds for marital dissolution. And what was marriage according to the Bear Court? It was fundamentally an economic relationship. This court, the Bear Court wrote, construes marriage as a partnership to which both parties bring their financial resources as well as their individual energies and efforts, as I have written in another context. Absent from this definition is any notion of procreation or the fidelity or loyalty owed by one partner to the other, or the partnership for life that the parties are expected to share. The definition the court proposes is virtually indistinguishable from the definition one might accord a business partnership between two persons. You eliminate the word both, and it might include a committee charged with planning a 4th of July celebration, or a school board setting its budget. Indeed, it could embrace nearly all forms of collaborative enterprise. The case of Goodrich versus the Department of Public Health, the same-sex case decided by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in the summer of 2003, is similarly reductionist in its approach to the purpose of marriage. The Goodrich Court affirmed that marriage served the welfare of the community, but what was meant by welfare bore no resemblance to the older understanding of marriage. It was not procreation or the education and upbringing of a new generation, but property management, distribution of social and economic benefits, and demographic record keeping that predominated in the court's analysis. Like the Bear decision 10 years before, the Massachusetts decision understands the essential elements of marriage to consist of civil benefits, joint property ownership, joint filing of income taxes, health and insurance benefits, and the like, that these make up the public understanding of marriage today, according to the Massachusetts court. I understand my task this morning to be that of an historian, to trace historical change. In my testimony, I have sought to explore the foundations of American marriage law in the Judeo-Christian tradition that the United States shares with the societies of Western Europe, the societies that comprised Western Christendom at the time of the Protestant Reformation. American lawyers and judges throughout the 19th and into the 20th century understood marriage as grounded in the natural law and embracing the essential Augustinian goods of procreation, fidelity, and permanence. The same-sex marriage decisions of the last 10 years, on the other hand, have employed a reductionist analysis of marriage. These decisions have generally avoided discussion of the substantive goods and goals of marriage. Marriage, rather, is seen as a state-created status and is a conduit for the conferral of state benefits. Marriage becomes simply one more social program. Seen in these terms, any attempt to define and classify marriage, or to acknowledge that it might have had important or might still have important substantive purposes, may seem arbitrary. One must wonder truly what the future holds for the legal institution of marriage.
Thank you, very much, Dr. Reed. Representative Lippman has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Professor Reed, following on your comments about Goodrich versus Department of Health, which I've certainly been wading through, I'm just wondering whether the state of Minnesota could, as a legitimate state interest, encourage folks to be heterosexual. Is that a legitimate state interest?
Is that a legitimate state interest?
Yes.
Speaking historically, certainly it has always been a legitimate state interest.
Could you tell us why?
Could I tell
Dr.
you? I think my am I following the right protocol?
You just go through the chair, so I'll recognize
you.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I haven't done one of these before.
That's fine. So, Dr. Reed?
Excuse me, Madam Chairman, Dr. Reed. Beyond Augustinian goods, I mean, are there linkages to case law that you could give us that would suggest that promotion of one set of sexual orientations over another might be a legitimate state interest?
Dr. Reed.
I can give you many references to case law. I have I've written an article on this. I can forward I mentioned the article extensively in my notes. I can certainly forward the entire article to you. I have some other materials as well I could forward to you. I've mentioned some of the highlights in my testimony, but I've got a 55-page law review article I could forward to you.
Thank you.
Would you be interested in my forwarding that to you?
Very much.
Dr. Reed, if you'd like to forward that to Dennis Bearden, our committee administrator, we'll see that members of the committee have access to that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor Reed, I want to ask maybe a broader question in your role as a historian, you know, recognizing the civil and both religious aspects of the institution of marriage. When we look at the scope and breadth of world history, really, are you aware of any major civilizations or which ones from any time and any place in the world recognized homosexual marriage and put it on the same civil and legal plane as heterosexual marriage?
Dr. Reed.
I am unaware of any civilization that has done that.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of brief questions of this nature. And conversely, looking at the same situation, are there any major civilizations you're aware of that did not recognize marriage at all and did not hold it as a social good and thus a more?
Marriage has been practiced and defined in different ways by different societies, but to the best of my knowledge, I believe every society has recognized some form of marriage as carrying for want of a better word, the anthropologists would use this word, sacral context. Marriage would convey, signify the procreative dimension of the human relationship in every society that I'm aware of.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And finally, to switch over to the religious side of things for a moment, how about recognized world religions? Are there any that recognize homosexual marriage as a sacrament or some integral part of their dogma, or conversely, major religions that don't speak at all to heterosexual marriage?
Dr. Reed.
Now, I believe in within the last year or so, some portions of the Anglican Communion may have taken this step, but I have not read thoroughly, immersed myself enough in that literature to know for certain. But I believe some portions. Now, the Anglican Communion is divided seriously on that point.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reed, you referred to on page 2 of your testimony natural law. Could you give us just a briefest overview of what might encompass natural law?
Dr. Reed.
Natural law is the belief, has its origins with Aristotle, with Cicero, that there are certain transcended principles and norms that should govern society. Aristotle and Cicero, and classical authors, both Christian and non-Christian, placed marriage as among the elements of natural law because of the necessity of providing a place where a family might be raised, where one might raise the next generation. So natural law, both understood in a non-Christian context, the context of writers like Aristotle and Cicero, and in the Christian context, the writings of someone like Thomas Aquinas or modern natural lawyers like John Finnis, marriage has always been seen as a basic component of the natural law.
Thank you, Dr. Reed. Brief follow-up?
Actually, no, Madam Chairman. Different direction.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Dr. Reed, in your testimony, you said that the state has granted special benefits to married people, whether it be tax status or whatever that is. And we have a 14th Amendment to our Constitution that says that the state will equally protect people under the law. And this may be completely out of your area of expertise, but do you think that because we grant married couples special treatment that we're actually not giving them equal treatment under the law?
Dr. Reed.
We permit all sorts of discrimination to go on with respect to the 14th Amendment, and the Supreme Court has adopted varying levels of scrutiny, from strict scrutiny to rational basis. Strict scrutiny, meaning that very little in the way of discriminatory treatment would be allowed. Rational basis, allowing a great deal. The tax code. Look at the tax code. The tax code creates, every page of the tax code is discriminatory in some respect or another. So certainly,
is proper to the state to treat people in different manners, depending on their situation, depending on their role in life, depending on the contributions to society, depending on judgments the state makes with respect to behaviors they should encourage. In the Clinton administration 10 years ago, the Family Leave Act was enacted. Now, if you're not in a family, you don't get access to the Family Leave Act, but we have it's meant to serve purposes. It's meant to serve to encourage family relationships. Family relationships are a legitimate part of the state's role.
Thank you, Dr. Reed. Representative Wardlow, we're near the end of our time. If you have a brief question for Dr. Reed.
Dr. Reed, if our whole country followed the lead of Massachusetts and this most recent definition of marriage, how does that bode for the strength of our society, say, 100 years from now?
Well,
Dr. Reed.
My apologies. I'm a historian. I don't predict the future, but I can say that if we take a reductionist approach to the definition of marriage, whereby virtually any collaborative enterprise could be fit within the definition of marriage, we will have, I believe, at least at the level of marital theory, effectively abolished marriage as a distinctive institution. The social consequences, well, that reminds me of what Joel Bishop said 100 years ago, and I'll read that. Evils numberless. This was written in 1891. Extending to the demoralization of society itself would follow the abandonment of marriage. Perhaps Bishop was speaking about our own age. I don't know. And I don't want to hazard a guess about 100 years from now.
Thank you. Dr. Reed. Representative Latt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I missed part of your presentation. I apologize for that, but I'm gathering that the essence of what you're saying is that marriage was at its root a religious institution initially, which sought to put a religious construct around what was essentially long-term mating behavior by the human species. Am I understanding that correctly?
Dr. Reed, briefly.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, and
Representative Latz.
Thank you. Doctor, is there any reason why, in your judgment, the institution of marriage needs to be enshrined in a constitutional amendment differently than in state statute?
Dr. Reed.
In addition to state statute.
Well, I will state that I am a newcomer to Minnesota, and I've moved here a year ago. I still do not have a strong sense of the way Minnesota law operates. But generally speaking, a constitutional amendment provides a greater strength, greater security to a principle of law. We put into the Constitution what we deem to be part of the fundamental law of the land. And speaking as someone who has lived in many states, I believe that is a fair and representative statement of state law nearly everywhere.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Reed. Next we'll move on to the testimony of Professor Teresa Stanton Collette. And Dr. Reed, there is a form for you to fill out at the stand with your name and address, if you could do that as well. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you.
And again, members, there is written testimony included in your materials from Professor Stanton Collette. If you'd state your name for the record and continue with your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chairman Holberg, members of the committee, distinguished guests. My name is Teresa Collette. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. The testimony I'm about to give does not represent the opinion of my employer, the University of St. Thomas School of Law, or any other organization or person. I'd like to orient my testimony toward answering Representative Latt's question with Madam Chairman's permission. And I'd like to focus my testimony, as my written testimony does, on providing the committee an overview of perhaps the present state of American marriage law and why it is that Minnesota, which does indeed have a statute that this legislature enacted just 7 short years ago, defining marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and expressly denying recognition of same-sex marriage, might well need to embrace a state constitutional amendment, or at least give the people of Minnesota the opportunity to decide whether to embrace a state constitutional amendment. And in order to do that, I think it's necessary to look at the current state of American marriage law. My colleague, Professor Reed, has given us an important historical perspective, but let's look at exactly how we got to where we are in the past 10 years. There was largely in this country a consensus that marriage was, by definition, the union of a man and a woman in this country until 1993. And in 1993, the Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii declared under its state constitution as a matter of equal protection that the state must prove a compelling state interest that would justify limiting marriage licenses to the union of a man and a woman. The people of Hawaii, by a margin of 2-1, amended their state constitution to declare that it is not sex discrimination, but rather that men and women are differently situated, as Professor Reed responded, and in fact, that marriage is an inherently heterosexual circumstance. However, they did adopt a statutory scheme that allowed same-sex couples to register as reciprocal beneficiaries, which afforded many benefits to those couples in that state. However, statistics from that state indicate very few same-sex couples have taken advantage of that opportunity. The next court to attempt to interpret a state constitution to force same-sex unions to be recognized as marriages was a trial court in the state of Alaska. That was in 1998. In Brazzi versus the Bureau of Vital Statistics. And that trial court took the state constitutional provision of privacy and declared that the state must issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Well, the state legislature in that case responded very quickly, and the people of Alaska, again, by a margin of 2-1, amended that state's constitution to say, marriage is the union of a man and a woman. And so, things were rather quiet for a year. And then the Vermont Supreme Court got into the action. And in Baker versus State, or Baker versus Vermont as it's now known, the Vermont Supreme Court declared under its Common Benefits Clause, which is very similar to the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution, yet different, as the Vermont Supreme Court noted, and I provide you the citation in my written testimony, marriage is a status that must be afforded to same-sex couples in that state, but not wanting to overstep the boundaries of judicial authority, we direct our legislature to craft some sort of status. Now, the Vermont legislature has a very interesting custom. When they meet, they must adjourn for a brief period of time during the legislative session, and they must go home and they must hold what are town hall meetings. I actually think that's a fine custom. And they must meet with their constituents. According to the New York Times, every town hall meeting A majority of those present expressed a desire to be able to vote on a constitutional amendment overriding the judicial directive to recognize same-sex marriage. But the Vermont legislature disregarded this directive and instead enacted what is now known as civil unions. Now, interestingly enough, when they passed civil unions, they did not include a residency requirement. And so, any two individuals in the United States, well, I suppose in the world, any two individuals can go to Vermont who are not able to legally marry otherwise and who are of age and obtain a civil union license. But having obtained a civil union license, they are subject to all the rights, privileges, and duties of marriage, including the duties related to dissolution, which means in order to apply for a divorce, you have to have been a resident for 6 months, and for that divorce to be finalized, you have to have been a resident for a year, which becomes somewhat problematic. More on that in just a few moments. Now, the Vermont Department of Vital Statistics website does not have the most recent report that they have distributed publicly. However, there is another website that provides a more up-to-date report, which indicates that of the approximate 5,000 civil union licenses, 84% have been provided to non-Vermont residents. That means only 16% of those licenses have been provided to Vermont residents. And according to news reports, a substantial number of same-sex couples in that state have not taken, a majority of same-sex couples in that state have not taken advantage of this status. The fact that the residency requirement forms a barrier to returning to Vermont to dissolve that status is of interest because it raises the interjurisdictional problem. And that leads me to the question of how has this been received in other states? Well, in fact, it has led to the issue of whether or not other states will recognize it. And Texas was the first state to recognize a Vermont civil union, oddly enough. One might not think Texas would be the first state, and yet there was, in fact, a Texas trial court, a trial court in Beaumont that received an uncontested divorce application based on the fact that the couple had been residents of Texas when they went to Vermont to get a civil union, returned to Texas, and wanted to dissolve their civil union, but did not want to have to move to Vermont and reside there for a year to get their divorce. The trial judge, because it was uncontested, entered the order, and it was only after the intervention of the Attorney General of the state of Texas saying, excuse me, in Texas, in order to get a divorce, you have to be married. Texas says to be married, you have to be a man and a woman. We believe you don't have the predicate facts to enter a divorce decree. It was only at that point that the trial judge withdrew his order and the couple withdrew their application. The very same year, a New York trial court recognized a Vermont civil union for purposes of a wrongful death action. That case has now been appealed to a New York appellate court. The New York City Bar has filed an amicus brief, according to the New York Bar Journal, just yesterday. In Iowa, a trial court judge also issued a divorce decree recognizing a same-sex civil union. That matter has been appealed by Iowa legislators. That state has a statutory Defense of Marriage Act, just like this state does. There are two appellate opinions refusing to recognize Vermont civil unions. Those arise in Georgia and Connecticut. Citations to those cases are in my written testimony. Well, what about marriage beyond that? What have we got pending? Sounds like beyond these civil union cases, there's really not much threat to the Minnesota law. Well, we have the Goodridge matter. Has it been finally resolved? No, it hasn't been finally resolved. The Massachusetts Supreme Court has ordered the Massachusetts legislature to issue some legislation consistent with its opinion that equal protection requires recognition of same-sex unions. And the Massachusetts Senate has requested an advisory opinion, which is permissible under the Massachusetts Constitution, as to whether or not civil unions similar to that under Vermont law would be acceptable. And on February 11th, a Massachusetts Constitutional Convention will be held by the legislature to determine whether or not to amend the Constitution of Massachusetts to define marriage as a man and a woman. But there are three other pending cases that are up on appeal where the issue is whether or not same-sex marriage must be recognized under the state constitutions. One is Morrison v. Sadler in Indiana. A second is Lewis v. Harris in New Jersey. I am not sanguine about the New Jersey Supreme Court. A third is Standhart v. Superior Court of Maricopa County. So we have three appeals that are still in play beyond the Massachusetts Supreme Court that has already declared that that state's constitution requires recognition of same-sex marriage. Beyond that, and because of the unique geographic location of Minnesota, we have the possibility of same-sex unions being raised to state officials or state courts from foreign jurisdictions. In Canada, there are two provincial courts that have ordered recognition of same-sex marriage, and there is a third provincial court that is considering the issue. Belgium has just declared the residence requirement is no longer in play, and it is sufficient if someone perpetually visits Belgium. Certainly, with the international corporations located in Minneapolis and St. Paul, that is not an unlikely scenario. In addition to that, the Netherlands recognizes same-sex marriage, although it continues to have a residency requirement for obtaining one. Each of these circumstances suggests that it is quite possible that in the very near future, a state official or judicial officer of this state will receive a challenge to our statute that prohibits recognition of same-sex marriage. It is true that the Minnesota Supreme Court a number of years ago found that same-sex marriage is not a part of Minnesota law. However, that was equally true in Massachusetts. It was equally true in Hawaii. That does not deny the reality of changing judicial norms, nor does it deny the democratic principle that critical questions of how we should order our common life together are best left to the people. It is appropriate for this legislative body to allow the people to decide this question. It is not an abrogation of your democratic responsibility. Rather, it is the fulfillment of your democratic responsibility. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Professor Collette? Representative Lippman.
Madam Chairman, Professor Collette, I was wondering if you would opine from your experience what you think the likelihood of a decision like Goodridge in Massachusetts emanating from the Minnesota Supreme Court based upon perhaps Stowe versus Gomez or other similar cases where they've construed the Minnesota Constitution. Is this a real and genuine risk or not a genuine risk?
Professor Collette.
Madam Chairman, in light of the Lawrence v. Texas case, although there was an explicit disavowment of its particular application to marriage, the Massachusetts Supreme Court expressly opened its opinion with Lawrence v. Texas. There is a real possibility of the Minnesota Supreme Court rendering a similar opinion. However, again, I rest my case for a constitutional amendment not on judicial overreaching, but on the fact that this is a key question that needs to be decided by the people, not by the judiciary.
Follow-up, Representative Lipman.
Yes, if you don't mind. Madam Chairman, Professor Collette, mindful of you bringing up Lawrence versus Texas and in the context of the Goodrich decision, one of the justices in the dissent in Goodrich says that Lawrence versus Texas or Bowers versus Hardwick or some of the other, even Griswold, is distinguishable because it's different. It's a different nature of government action when it intrudes in the intimate bedroom by prohibiting conduct, as opposed to what the dissent at least saw the state of Massachusetts was doing, which was not conferring a set of benefits. Withholding the benefits is different than going in with state action or police action into regulating conduct. Just not conferring those benefits is somehow distinguishable. Would you agree with the dissent in that, and perhaps you could assess that argument?
Professor Collette.
Madam Chairman, Representative, for purposes of candor, I should advise the committee that I was counsel to an amicus in the Lawrence case that filed on the state, on the side of the state of Texas. There was an argument that heightened scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, should be applied to the Texas sodomy law, and I filed on behalf of three women's organizations that argued that, in fact, it was not a sex discrimination case and that rational basis scrutiny should be applied. And therefore, it is, as counsel, it was clearly my position that the statute was a valid exercise of police power, and so it would be an inconsistent position for me to take that it would not be permissible for the state to regulate.
Very, very briefly?
Very, very briefly, Representative Lipman.
Madam Chairman, Professor Collette, could you briefly summarize the rational basis arguments you made as amicus in Lawrence versus Texas? I mean, why would the state of Minnesota have a rational basis to distinguish along these lines?
Professor Collette.
Madam Chairman, and in part in response to your earlier question to my colleague, Professor Reed, the most recent United Nations report on population finds that one of the most grave problems that will arise by the year 2020 is depopulation, and many nations.
You know what? We have to have order in the room, and if you don't, we'll have you removed. If you continue, Professor Collette.
Certainly. And many nations in Western Europe, particularly Italy and Japan, which is not, of course, in Western Europe, but nonetheless an industrialized nation, are finding that their taxation policy and their social security policy are having to be modified because of the population distribution. And so one may argue that the marriage schema being limited to heterosexuals in order to encourage the childbearing aspect of marriage clearly is a rational and legitimate basis that would support the heightened rational basis standard even under Romer v. Evans.
Very good, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Rapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, in 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education found language in the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution that was not explicitly written in the U.S. Constitution, that concluded that separate but equal education between blacks and whites was unconstitutional, overruled its own decision in Plessy versus Ferguson from about 100 years earlier. And it was labeled as judicial activism because it explicitly declared unconstitutional many state statutory schemes that had enshrined discrimination in the provision of education and became the basis for overruling a lot of other statutory schemes of discrimination. Would you consider Brown versus Board of Education to have been inappropriate judicial activism?
Professor Klett.
Madam Chairman, Representative, Brown versus Education was not inappropriate judicial activism. However, it was also buttressed by the Civil Rights Act, which was a legislative act, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Professor. Representative Latz, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair. The Civil Rights Act, of course, was passed about 10 years later. So it was the judiciary that led the way in that matter. A follow-up question.
Right here.
You indicated that the key question here needs to be decided by the people, not the judiciary. Last time I checked, I was elected by people in my district to make decisions, and I stand for election every 2 years, and they can pass judgment on whether I've made decisions consistent with their opinions and their views on issues. Is not democratically elected representative government a form of decision-making by the people?
Professor Klett.
Madam Chairman, Representative, it is indeed, which is why I'm here today urging you to make the decision in favor of allowing the people to vote on this.
Thank you. Representative DeForest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor Klett, I had a quick question here for one who does not litigate for a living. If this issue were to reach the Minnesota Supreme Court, do we know or do you have an opinion on what the standard of review would be? And furthermore, would it depend upon the particular issue, say, recognizing a civil union as opposed to recognizing the dissolution?
Professor Klett.
Madam Chairman, Representative, it certainly would depend upon the facts and the context in which it was cast. Courts across the country have adopted different standards of review, and as I was responding to one of the other Representative Whitman's question earlier, there is some confusion in light of Romer v. Evans and Lawrence v. Texas now as to whether rational basis means the traditional rational basis that has been employed looking at legislative enactments, or whether there's some sort of heightened standard when you're dealing with issues that touch upon homosexuality.
Thank you. Representative Lyles, you have like 1 minute.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Professor, would you support a statutory construct that provided the same legal rights to same-sex unions as are granted to marriages without labeling those rights marriage?
Professor Klett.
Madam Chairman, I am opposed to the civil union statute that was passed by Vermont, and I believe what you're suggesting is the same thing.
Representative Letts, thank you. The next, Professor Klett, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate the information. The next testifier on our list for today is Mr. Grote, Executive Director for Outfront Minnesota.
Madam Chairman?
Representative Whitman.
As Mr. DeGroote makes her way to the podium, I guess in response to Representative Latz, I would imagine that Professor Klett would oppose that legislation. She would agree that the legislature is fully empowered to pass such an act, which is the important distinction. She might not, as a citizen, a favorite, but I'm sure she would agree that we have the power to enact such a measure.
Madam Chair, is Representative Lippman preparing to author such a bill?
Representative Latz, I have no idea. Mr. Grote, cool it. Mr. Grote, you'd step to the podium, state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Ann DeGroote. I'm the Executive Director of Outfront Minnesota. We're the state's largest organization dedicated to the betterment of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender citizens in our state. I'm pleased to be here today, and thank you for your time. First of all, I want to say that while the discussion about marriage is an emotional and complicated one for people, I think it is an important conversation for us to be having at this time. It is something that we're talking about on the national level, on the statewide level, and we talk about in our own homes and our own localities. And it only makes sense at some point that we begin to discuss it in this policy arena. So I am pleased to be able to have the opportunity to discuss this and bring it to some issues to light. I want to share with you a couple of things about marriage. I believe that marriage in this country, as in the world, is in a process of evolution and has always been. Marriage is not one thing that it has always been. It is one thing that has evolved over time. And while the laws in the United States have historically stated that marriage is between a man and a woman, that only really gives us part of the story about a marriage in this country and in the world. Up until recently, as most of us know, women were considered the property of their husbands. Many of the women serving in the legislature, people in jobs like mine, women serving in business, would not be doing so today if they were considered to be the property of their husbands yet. Those women would be doing what their husbands told them to do. The status of marriage and the status of men and women in marriage has changed dramatically in that way. This is one way in which marriage has evolved over time. Prior to the end of the Civil War, slaves were not allowed to be married. They were considered property. And one property could not marry another property and be the property owner of the property. It was not something that was considered appropriate or correct. As we ended slavery, we also evolved marriage in another way, and we allowed two consenting adults to marry each other and to have families and to begin to develop stable communities in which to live. Until the late 1940s, marriage between people of two different races was considered to be inappropriate, and in fact there were strict laws in many states that barred marriage between two people of different races. The Supreme Court ruled this unconstitutional, and in fact I think in the minds of many people, including myself, and I think in the words of many legal scholars, if this were brought forward to the people for a vote in Virginia in the 40s, this would not have passed. The Supreme Court led the way there, and the people would not have voted against miscegenation in Virginia. And there were severe societal sanctions against women when they divorced. Now, we still see vestiges of this in the world that we live in our culture. But not in the manner that we did in the 40s, 50s, and even in the 60s. Divorced women do not have that same mark against her that they did in the past. This is also an evolution that is not exactly about marriage, but it is about the dissolution of marriage. So marriage is something that has changed over time. I cannot speak to it historically going back a lot further, but I can talk a little bit about, as I did, the kinds of things we've seen in the recent 150 to 200 years. Marriage in the United States confers upon it a number of different civil benefits. The General Accounting Office lists 1,049 benefits that accrue to people when they get a marriage license. Those benefits range everything from inheritance benefits to hospital visitation benefits to tax benefits, Social Security, retirement. I do not think that most people understand that when they get a marriage license, what those things are that come with it. When I've talked to people about what it means for same-sex couples, for example, not to be able to be married in this society, and I tell them what that actually means in terms of wills, taxes, in terms of custody of our children, in terms of how we would split up a home if we were to break up, what all of those things mean, and the things we have to do legally to protect ourselves, they're surprised. They don't always understand what comes with marriage. Therefore, I think that from a civil perspective, marriage benefits, and in fact, it favors one group of citizens over another. I do not think that the role of public policy in this country is to favor one group of people over another. All citizens in this country pay taxes. We all contribute to the community that we live in. We're good citizens. We vote. We should be able to take advantage of the same benefits and have the same responsibilities as everyone else. And for a government, state, federal government, city, to say one group benefits more than another is inappropriate in a democracy. In this country, as in many other countries, marriage has both a civil and a religious aspect. People get a marriage license. That's a civil process. Okay? But religions also conduct marriages and enter into covenants between people in some cases and other kinds of contracts that people use in the religious world. In this context we're talking about today, I think it's important to keep in mind that we're talking about the civil aspect, not the religious aspect. In no way should the government make religious decisions. In no way should the government make civil decisions based on a religious perspective. And on the other hand, in no way should religions make civil decisions. So what we're talking about today really has to do with the role of the government and the role of the civil world. And in marriage, all along the years, that's what we've been talking about. And those are the items I brought forward to you today. This is a very emotional topic for people. It's a very difficult topic for people. It goes to core beliefs, and it goes to core security. And it goes to really what are the building blocks of the society that we live in. Marriage is an extremely important institution. Coupling is an important institution. And regardless of orientation, regardless of who the two people are in that marriage, the civil authority ought to recognize that as a marriage and not favor one group over another group. I might add to, speaking as a person who works for the betterment of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, that I know many, many, many same-gender couples who have been together for many years, 30, 40 years, who are in what is a marriage without the civil benefits of marriage. These people have model relationships that many people could benefit from looking at. And I think when we start talking about those folks as less than other people, Britney Spears, for example, and others, we denigrate some people in our community, and policy should never seek to denigrate anyone. Policy should seek to uplift everyone. So I appreciate the chance to speak today, and I would be happy to entertain questions that people might have for me.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Groot, I agree with you entirely, 100%, that it's an emotional and difficult topic about core beliefs and Minnesota institutions. And I, for one, but both as a citizen and as a legislator, greatly appreciate your professionalism and the way that you have a maturity and the way that you've approached the topic. And I hope that you will be mindful that the folks who are considering and debating and struggling with this issue, you know, come to it with good faith as well. But I do have a question. I was stirred, of course, by your historical perspective, particularly with reference to the struggle against slavery, of which Minnesota was a key part, mm-hmm. and also the suffragette movement. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Rochester, New York, birthplace of Susan B. Anthony. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that the history in both of those occasions leads to an opposite conclusion that you have here, which is in those circumstances, the civil rights action or the moving forward, the progression away from discriminatory behavior was as a result of consensus based upon the amendment process. The 13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th amendments to the Constitution restructured the constitutional order in a way that we probably both would agree what was the better way. Why would not the
analog for folks who are in Outfront Minnesota and supporting same-sex unions or same-sex marriage be to develop their own bill, try to get it on the ballot, and let's have an up or down vote.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chairperson and Representative Lippman. I think there are a number of issues there. One is that it isn't quite a simple process as that. It was an evolution of a long time of people in social movements making change, and those social movements resulted in laws being changed, and in fact, in some cases, amendments being made. Those amendments were directly in the federal constitution, related to the federal constitution. Our federal constitution originally talked about slavery, and so amendments were needed to say that was not the kind of thinking that at this point in time we think this is good for this country. So amendments were needed at this time. In this case, it is my belief that an amendment is not necessary to the Minnesota Constitution. Not only do we have two laws that talk about what marriage is at this point in time, much as I disagree with them, all right, but I do not think that it is the place in our Constitution to begin to start sort of putting stuff in there. You know, I think people ought to think about, you know, what is the role of the Constitution? And is my understanding that the Constitution is created to protect the rights of the minority in a majority culture. And when we do that and we start institutionalizing and codifying oppression of one group of people over another, I don't think that's what the Constitution was meant for. And I am actually looking forward to the discussion of legal scholars about really what's the role of the Constitution. So we would not put forward a constitutional amendment because I think it's an inappropriate thing to do.
Representative Lippman, follow up.
Very briefly, Chairman Holberg, Mr. Groot, I watched with considerable interest your appearance on At Issue mm-hmm. with Tom Hauser 2 weeks ago debating Senator Bachman. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that stirred me in your remarks there, and perhaps you could address or amplify it even more here today, was your view that that the constitutional order and constitutional liberty should be revealed to us, and perhaps I'm characterizing it, but should be revealed to us by the Supreme Court or a majority of the justices on the Supreme Court as to what the Constitution is, and that it's less appropriate to have the rest of us rabble in the process of voting on a constitutional amendment involved in the discussion of what the constitutional liberty is. From my perspective, I see that as a wider discussion beyond four justices that involves all 4.5 million of us, and that a narrower role for the courts is better for liberty as we understand it. Perhaps you could respond.
Mr. Group.
Madam Chairperson and Representative Lippman, let me be clear about what I was saying. What I was saying is that the Supreme Court played an appropriate role, which is that they were determining the constitutionality of an issue brought before them. That is their job. That is what they do. Most justices, judges in this country, at the state level, are elected people. They are elected by people who elect them to represent them. So these are elected folks. And they are elected to do the third branch of government, as you know, the judiciary, which is to make sure that the Constitution is being adhered to. And that's what they did. And that's what they would do in Minnesota as well if a case like that were brought before them, is determine the constitutionality. And that's what I was talking about.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members.
Thank you. Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Mr. Groot, I have an issue here I'm grappling with, and I have two different questions. Maybe they're the same question, so I'll try to work my way through to get to the correct answer. You had mentioned there are 1,049 benefits to being married, and I'm not going to question that that's true or not true. I completely believe it. And if we're talking about equal protection under our Constitution, there are just two avenues, I guess, that we can take to resolve this issue. One would be we could add civil unions of some type and give them those 1,049 benefits. Or alternatively, we could take those 1,049 benefits away from what we call married couples.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm curious which would be your preferable action in this case, and if you believe there is some inherent benefit to society to what we'll call couples in general. And then I do have one follow-up because I'm still more confused.
Mr. Groot.
Madam Chairperson and Representative Burrell, I don't think we should take benefits away from anyone. I believe in marriage. I think it's an important aspect of our society. I think marriage should be something that can be enjoyed by all citizens, regardless of sexual orientation. So I don't think benefits should be taken away. I think there are more options than civil unions. In the best of all worlds, I would like it if people, regardless of sexual orientation, could be married and take advantage of all the benefits and responsibilities that marriage has for everybody in this society. I think that's fair. I think that's just fair. So there is no reason why we would take benefits away from one group. What we need to do is make sure that everyone can take advantage of the same thing.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as marriage is evolving, do you see marriage evolving into more than two individuals?
That is not...
Mr. Groot.
I'm sorry, Madam.
That's all right.
And Representative Burrell. That is not something that I'm advocating for or have ever advocated for or have an interest in advocating for. If someday a group of people wants to come forward and advocate for multiple partners, that will be something that they will do, but that is not what we are doing.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest. Thank you. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to let you see my mindset on this. I was speaking with Representative Latz during a committee yesterday, and I got the opinion, you know, I agree with him. I have some trepidation at amending the Constitution for things that maybe shouldn't be there, and I think you alluded to that. But what I'm thinking, and you said that you're a representative, we're all representing our people, and we should do what they want, or they elected us to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if 60% of the people on a certain issue agree with me, and 40% don't, and I vote with 60%, regardless of what the issue is, that 40% really get left out. And in most of the time, it's okay. And I was told that, you know, if I agree with you 80% of the time, I'm glad I elected you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but sometimes it's 60-40, 50-50. Maybe it's 40-60 the other way. And if it's an extremely important issue like this, what I'm struggling with this is, should we put it before the people because it's so important or not? And that's my debate within myself.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow, I'm sorry, was there a question there or was that just a statement?
I guess it was a statement.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Latt.
Madam Chair, Ms. DeGroot and Representative Wardlow, there are, as an elected official, I was a poli sci major in college, so some of this I come by naturally, but the academics look at the role of representatives in government as twofold. One is to try to represent the views of their constituents as much as possible, but the other, because this is a representative government and not direct democracy, is also to apply our own judgment to the issues, because we are sitting here learning in much more detail about all these issues than almost any of our constituents will, and we do this day in and day out. You know, there are going to be times, and Ms. DeGroot, I appreciate your feedback on this as well, there will be times when I may end up making a judgment that on an issue that is of my district would give me a different answer. But part of what they're electing me to do is to learn in more detail about the issue that I'm deciding and make my own independent judgment about it, because they're electing me to because they trust my judgment on issues, I hope, as much as because I generally tend to agree with how they would approach issues. Any feedback on that, Mr. Groove?
Mr. Groove?
Madam Chairperson and Representative Latz, you know, I appreciate a great deal the difficulty of this topic. I really appreciate it's very difficult. I have had my own challenges with this topic myself. Because I'm a feminist, and I think that there are things about marriage that we need to talk about in the community. But as a a lesbian in a relationship and as a woman who is a leader in her community, I've got to tell you that it is so important to recognize the relationships of all of us. It will lead and add to the betterment of our community, and we need to not be choosing one group over another. That I just think this is such an important topic, and I really am asking elected people to take leadership on this, even if our communities at large don't understand or agree. And I think it's very hard to do that, and I understand that. What I've asked from my own community, from the people who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, from people in same-sex relationships, is to talk about their relationships, to talk about what it is to be a couple with someone for 10 years, and maybe you haven't even told your family before. Maybe you've been referring to that person as your roommate. Talk about what it is when your partner is in the hospital and you can't visit them. Talk about what it is to go to a family gathering with somebody you've been with for 20 years and not have them looked at the same as your sister or brother's third or fourth spouse. Talk about what this is for us, because I really think that in the same way as gay, lesbian, bi, and transgender people, we have been coming out, and our coming out has really changed the world in terms of our lives. It's very unusual for anyone to say, I don't know one anymore. It is also important for us to come out about our lives and our relationships and our families so that people do understand. It makes a difference when you talk one-on-one to someone and you introduce your partner and you talk about your life. You talk about the joys, the difficulties. You know, I have a married sister and a married brother, and I have to tell you that the issues they face and I face are not really at all different, except for the fact that I'm in a same-sex relationship and that that adds another veneer to my life. But to talk about those things is valuable, and I think it will help all of you in your roles as you make this very difficult decision. But I do think leadership sometimes that is maybe different than your constituents is what's required.
Thank you very much for your comments. We've digressed here a little bit. We'll move on to our next presenter. It's Associate Professor Kathy Hall from the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hall, if you'd like to state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Kathleen Hall. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota. Marriage is one of my primary research and teaching interests. I'm currently completing a book tentatively titled The Cultural Politics of Same-Sex Marriage. I'm also conducting research on the U.S. marriage movement, which seeks to revitalize the institution of marriage and reduce rates of divorce, cohabitation, and unmarried childbearing. I created and teach an undergraduate course called Love, Sex, and Marriage. I'm pleased to be here today to share some thoughts about the social and cultural history of marriage. I cannot provide a comprehensive history of marriage in the brief time available, so I will focus on the themes and developments that seem most relevant. I think virtually all scholars of marriage would agree that if we view marriage in broad historical perspective, we see a story of incredible change and diversity, and sometimes conflict. Marriage is an institution that changes with society, and this flexibility is probably what has kept marriage strong and vital across the sweep of centuries. Marriage has changed in many ways over time. It has changed in terms of its boundaries, who is allowed to marry, its purpose, why people marry, and its content, the arrangements within marriage relationships. Many of the significant changes in marriage have been stimulated by changes in economic conditions. Other changes have resulted from changing beliefs about human difference, such as differences based on gender, race, or sexuality. For most of recorded history, marriage has been primarily an economic and political arrangement, bearing little resemblance to the marriage institution that we have today. Until the modern era, marriages among more prosperous classes were not a matter of individual choice based on love, attraction, or compatibility. Rather, marriage was a family affair used to forge economic relationships and political alliances across kin groups. And marriages were quite explicitly economic exchanges between families. Most pre-modern societies operated under a system of either dowry, in which the bride's family made a payment to the groom's family, or bride price, in which the groom's family made payment to the bride's. Laborers in pre-modern times had somewhat more individual freedom than the wealthy in choosing their marriage partners, but they also approached marriage as an economic decision. Indeed, they could ill afford to do otherwise in an economy in which spouses functioned as de facto business partners, working collectively to produce their economic output. And for the very poorest in pre-modern times, slaves, serfs, and paupers, legal marriage was generally a luxury beyond reach. There's broad consensus among marriage scholars that industrialization and the spread of capitalism brought significant change to the institution of marriage in the West. These new economic conditions define the modern era and spell the end of the family as a significant economic unit. Instead, people, mostly males, ventured out to sell their labor for wages as individuals. Although many working class wives also contributed to the family income as wage laborers, marriage lost its former function as an economic partnership, characterized by the functional interdependence of the spouses. This momentous change made room for change in the way people chose their marriage partners. Other changes, such as the rise of cities and the population's increasing geographic mobility, also had an impact. Adults were exposed to a wider range of people and thus potential marriage partners than ever before. And for the first time, they could afford to base marriage decisions on love and attraction. So with the rise of modernity, we witness the rise of romantic love as a primary basis for marriage. In the early modern era, people had more choice in forming marriages, but marriage was still viewed primarily as the socially sanctioned site for procreation. However, as industrialization advanced and child mortality rates declined, children lost their economic utility within families. They became a financial drain instead of an income source. As a result, married couples sought to limit the size of their families, leading to fierce debates in the late 19th and early 20th century over the use of contraception within marriage. The spread of contraception became a primary target of anti-vice crusaders, who did not hesitate to label contraceptive marital sex a crime against nature, likening it to masturbation, adultery, prostitution, and atheism. In a 1926 Atlantic Monthly article titled "The Fallacious Propaganda for Birth Control," one author warned that contraception within marriage, quote, challenges the permanence of the state. Such activity is distinctly antisocial, for it enables selfish people to escape their responsibility, ultimately to their own detriment and to the injury of the state, end quote. When this issue was finally settled in favor of married couples' right to control their own fertility, a new vision of a marriage had been created. Procreation was no longer assumed to be the primary or exclusive purpose of marriage. Love, companionship, and pleasure had become socially acceptable reasons for the expression of marital sexuality. I would like to focus now specifically on a few key features of the history of marriage within the United States. Again, I think it will be clear that the history of marriage in this country has been one of change and evolution, sometimes accompanied by significant social conflict. Through much of our history, marriage was a site of significant gender inequality. Under the legal doctrine of coverture, a married woman's legal identity was subsumed under her husband's. A woman's assets, labor, and earnings were defined as the property of her husband. She lost many legal rights she had held before marriage, such as the right to own property, the right to enter contracts, and the right to bring lawsuits. The theory was that her legal and economic interests would be protected and defended by her husband, although the reality was, of course, sometimes different. The push to repeal coverture and grant married women equal and independent legal rights began in the mid-19th century with the passage of laws that allowed married women to own their own property. But it was a long process. In fact, the last remnants of coverture were not expunged from our legal codes until the 1980s, when the last of the states got rid of their marital rape exemptions, laws that said that forced sex within marriage was not legal rape because men had a legal right to their wives' bodies. So with regard to gender, the story of American marriage is the story of a slow and gradual movement from gender hierarchy to gender equality. For most of American history, most African Americans were prohibited from forming legal marriages because slaves were not allowed to marry. Under American property law, slaves were property, and it would make no sense to allow property to enter contracts and exercise the same rights enjoyed by their owners. Historian Michael Grossberg quotes a 19th century judge who ruled that slaves could not take on the domestic obligations of marriage without, quote, doing violence to the rights of the owner. Such a position made sense to many 19th century Americans because they took for granted that slaves were inferior, irresponsible, childish, even subhuman. Of course, slaves married anyway. They engaged in a range of cultural practices, including wedding ceremonies officiated by preachers to mark their marital commitments. Slave marriages often lasted for decades and were governed by unwritten community norms. However, these relationships had no legal standing as marriages. Within our own lifetimes, less than four decades ago, laws banning interracial marriages were still on the books in many American states. 41 states had such laws at some point in their history. Challenges to these laws became more common over time, but judges routinely upheld them, citing the unnaturalness and/or the sinfulness of race mixing. A Florida judge summarized these arguments in a 1955 ruling that declared, "Segregation is and always has been the unvarying law of the animal kingdom. The dove and the quail, the turkey and the turkey buzzard, the chicken and the guinea, it matters not where they are found, are segregated. Place the horse, the cow, the sheep, the goat, and the pig in the same pasture, and they instinctively segregate. When God created man, he allotted each race his own continent according to color." The tide began to turn in 1948 when the California Supreme Court struck down that state's anti-miscegenation law, finding it a violation of the 14th Amendment promise of equal protection. This ruling prompted about half of the states that had anti-miscegenation statutes to repeal them. But 16 states still had such laws when the U.S. Supreme Court declared them unconstitutional in 1967 in the aptly titled Loving versus Virginia case. It is worth noting that it was the courts that often played the lead role in dismantling these racist and discriminatory anti-miscegenation statutes. And they did so at a time when the majority of the American population still believed that interracial marriage was morally wrong. At the time of the Loving decision, a Gallup poll found that 72% of Americans disapproved of interracial marriages, and 48% believed they should be punished as a crime. There has been a rather remarkable consistency in the rhetoric of those opposing change or evolution in the marriage institution throughout the history of our country. Regardless of the specific issue at hand, those who have opposed change in marriage have repeatedly predicted the downfall of marriage and sometimes of civilization itself in the wake of change and reform. Furthermore, those who have opposed changes to the marriage institution have often invoked both God and nature in support of their cause. This brings us to same-sex marriage. No cultural and social history of marriage would be complete without acknowledging that marriage relationships have existed among same-sex partners throughout history and across a range of cultures. Same-sex marriage is not a recent invention of contemporary gays and lesbians. We have evidence of same-sex marriage relationships in pre-modern Western cultures, as well as in Asian, African, and Native American cultures. In modern Western culture, same-sex marriages have, until fairly recently, met a fate similar to the American slave marriages of the pre-Civil War era. That is, they have been denied legal recognition, but have been celebrated and even sanctified through a range of cultural and religious practices. Although some religious denominations are strongly opposed to same-sex relationships and thus to same-sex marriage, other denominations are supportive of same-sex couples and treat committed same-sex partnerships as marriages within their religious doctrine and practice. There is strong anecdotal evidence suggesting that public rituals celebrating same-sex relationships, whether called commitment ceremonies, holy unions, or simply marriages, have increased in popularity among gay and lesbian couples in recent years. The past few decades have brought rapid change in the legal treatment of same-sex unions, with legal recognition for same-sex couples spreading both here and internationally. Five U.S. states and dozens of cities and counties have extended benefits and protections to same-sex couples. The most comprehensive forms of recognition include Vermont's civil unions law and California's domestic partnership law, which extend all the state-level rights, benefits, and responsibilities of marriage to same-sex relationships. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruling last November promises to deliver marriage rights to same-sex couples in that state later this year. However, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and comparable laws passed in most U.S. states currently limit the effects of legal recognition for same-sex couples in states like Vermont, California, and Massachusetts. These U.S. developments are part of a broader trend toward heightened recognition for same-sex relationships throughout the industrialized West. The Netherlands became the first country to grant same-sex couples full marriage rights in 2001, and Belgium followed its lead 2 years later. In the wake of court rulings establishing same-sex marriage rights in the provinces of Ontario and British Columbia, Canada is moving toward national legislation to enact same-sex marriage throughout the country. Several northern European countries have granted relationship rights through registered partnerships, which provide almost all of the benefits of marriage to same-sex couples. The French Civil Solidarity Pact law makes a more limited set of rights available to both same-sex and opposite-sex couples, and the German Life Partnership Act extends a similar set of rights to same-sex couples only. Hungary and Portugal include same-sex couples under their laws regulating common law marriage. Other countries moving towards same-sex recognition include Great Britain, Switzerland, and the Czech Republic. And in 2003, the European Parliament issued a report urging all member states of the European Union to extend marriage and adoption rights to same-sex couples. I hope this brief review of marriage history has illustrated that marriage is far from a static social institution. Rather, its history has been characterized by significant, ongoing change, sometimes at the expense of considerable social conflict. The purpose of marriage has shifted. Where marriages were once formed based mainly on economic and political considerations, today Western marriages are formed based on intimacy and attraction. The legal boundaries of marriage have shifted. Legal marriage once excluded people based on racial and class considerations. Today the primary exclusion is based on a gender requirement. I believe that marriage will continue to change as society continues to change. The eventual inclusion of same-sex couples in American legal marriage appears inevitable. An impartial reading of history suggests that the expansion of the marriage institution toward greater fairness and inclusion does not weaken the institution, but instead makes it stronger. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Representative Whitman. Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Professor Hall, I have two quick questions. First, you mentioned Loving versus Virginia, and I do agree it's aptly titled. In Loving, the Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional the Virginia's miscegenation statute prohibiting whites from marrying non-whites because it concluded that the statute was intended to preserve white supremacy over non-white people. Is it your view that Minnesota's marriage laws are intended to preserve the supremacy of heterosexuals over homosexuals? And if you do believe that, can you tell me why you think Minnesota's marriage laws were intended to have that effect?
Ms. Hall.
Madam Chairman, Representative Littman, I would not necessarily assign such conscious intent to the framers of Minnesota's marriage laws or other marriage laws around the country. However, I think the current status of marriage law in this country does have the effect of maintaining heterosexual privilege And I think, I'm not a lawyer, but if I could just expand a bit on the Loving decision. One of the interesting things is that in Loving and a number of other cases, Griswold versus Connecticut and so on, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it clear that it considers marriage a fundamental right under the Constitution. And fundamental rights are subject to strict scrutiny under the schema of equal protection, meaning they have to meet the highest standard for having a basis that justifies treating people differently. And I think that given the shifts that we've seen in the history of marriage and what marriage has evolved into, which is a way for people to protect and sustain relationships, to take responsibility for their partners legally and in other ways, it's not clear that excluding non-heterosexual couples from marriage serves a legitimate government purpose. So I think that is the reason that we're seeing increasing sort of judicial openness to those kinds of arguments.
Representative Lippman.
Madam Chairman, Professor Hall, a slightly different tack. You opened your remarks noting that the institution of marriage has undergone incredible change, I believe diversity and conflict, as you said, over the years, that it's non-static, and that it now it's your thesis that it has different purposes than perhaps originally as cast. My question to you is, if all of those are true, assuming that all of those are true, wouldn't the best way to manage that conflict as a polity, as we are as Minnesotans, on a divisive issue like that, which is non-static and which is changing, is to have a constitutional debate and to resolve those questions at the ballot box with all 4.5 million of us?
I'm sorry, Professor Hall.
I wish I were a representative.
Maybe you don't.
Madam Chairwoman, Representative Lippman, I'd respectfully disagree with you, because I think if the question of these anti-miscegenation statutes had been put to a vote in 1967, they would not have been struck down. For all I know, we might still have them today. And I think that that's why we have courts, and that's why we have a separate judicial branch in our system of government, is that we don't put fundamental rights to a vote, that we ensure some basic level of protection for minorities, including unpopular minorities, including minorities that the majority believes they are superior to in some on some basis, whether it's a belief in racial superiority or a belief in the sinfulness of someone's sexuality, that the founders of the Constitution recognized that there would be unpopular minorities in democracies and that everything couldn't be left to a vote.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Letts.
Madam Chair, Professor, I would note the original founders of our country were themselves unpopular minorities in Europe, and that's why they escaped to this new continent. I guess, Professor, wouldn't an additional response to Representative Lippman's question be that if indeed the institution of marriage is non-static and changing, that the last thing we want to do is to enshrine it in cement in the Constitution, which is so difficult to change in response to shifting societal norms?
Professor Al.
Yes, I would basically agree with that statement. I personally believe, and I believe many conservatives in this country would agree, that this would be a somewhat inappropriate use of the Constitution, and that in general the Constitution is meant to sort of frame the basic rights and responsibilities of people, and that when we start using the Constitution to deny or take away rights from people instead of to expand and protect people's rights, that's probably a perversion of why constitutions exist in the first place.
Thank you. Any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you again for your test vote. I'm sorry. Representative De La Forest, you almost got your pass.
Yeah, I know. I took a pass on the last one. So I just, you know, it's an interesting debate, and this is an interesting discussion. I think the important issue here is discussing this Constitution, but I'm a little bit confused, Professor Hall, by
the testimony that you said the Constitution shouldn't be used to take away rights or confer rights on people, but really, as a democratic republic, you know, aren't our rights founded primarily on the Constitution? You know, I look at an issue like this, and I think regardless of where you stand on it, we all agree that this is an important issue and it's a very emotional issue. And I don't have my blue book in front of me, but I know in the Minnesota Constitution we've talked about hunting and fishing rights, we've talked about taconite tax and other things like that. You know, why would it be inappropriate to have the people of Minnesota decide an issue that is so fundamental like this that really in many respects defines who we are as a people? And after all, this proposed amendment really is simply going to pose a question to the people. And I agree with Representative Latz that there is a tension between our role to stand in the stead of all 37,000 of our constituents and make decisions on their behalf. But sometimes, isn't there a situation where when we get a fundamental issue really defining who we are, that we say, let's let the people inform us regarding this decision?
Professor Hall.
Madam Chairwoman, Professor
Delaforest. Oh, no, don't do that.
Representative Delaforest. If I said that I don't think the Constitution is the place to confer rights, I misspoke. I don't think it's the place to deny rights. I certainly think many rights are conferred in state and federal constitutions. Again, I would just reiterate what I said a moment ago, that I think the reason we have constitutions is that we want to have a framework in which certain fundamental rights are not put to a vote, and that we have a judicial branch that can protect those rights for unpopular minorities that would never win those rights in a popular vote. So this is perhaps just a difference in belief or philosophy about how our system of government is set up.
Right, thank you.
One very quick
question.
Representative, this is a very interesting debate. I'm curious then, just your personal opinion, where do you believe the right to a marriage is derived, if not founded in a particular jurisdiction's constitution?
Professor Hall.
I believe it is a constitutional right, and what the U.S. Supreme Court has said with the federal constitution is that it is a fundamental right, meaning that the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness certainly must include such things as the right to live in a legally recognized relationship with the life partner of your choice. And that is where the U.S. Supreme Court has based its interpretation of marriage as a fundamental right. And this is not, I mean, they've stated that quite flatly in a number of major decisions. So I do believe it is seated within the constitutional language and interpretation.
All right. Representative Burrell, very quickly.
Madam Chair, it's just a request of Professor Hall. The information you gave us, I took a lot of notes here, but I didn't get one-eighth of what you said. Would you be willing to make available in written form your testimony today?
Yes, and I actually have copies with me that I can...
would appreciate.
Great. Thank you very much, Professor Hall. And there's a young lady here in the white shirt that would be happy to take those copies and distribute them to the committee on your behalf. Again, thank you for your comments. Our last testifier today will be Professor Gary Simpson from Luther Seminary, and Representative DeLaForest. Representative Lippman has his handy copy of the Minnesota Constitution. I notice it's well read and marked up, but I'm sure that you can use it briefly, but he will want it back. Welcome to the committee, Professor Simpson. You'd state your name for the record, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. My name is Gary Simpson. I am Professor of Systematic Theology at Luther Seminary here in St. Paul, Minnesota. Which means I teach Christian doctrine and ethics. In ethics, I also teach the ethics of sexuality and marriage, presently writing, researching a book on sexuality and marriage called Honoring God in Sex on Purpose. And it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Simpson.
Look at the wonderful layer cake structure in there, said Steve Squires, the Mars mission's main scientist, just yesterday. It's going to be fascinating beyond words to get up close and personal with this thing. Today I come to you to talk about the holy estate of matrimony, as Lutherans have traditionally named it, and to help you get some critical knowledge about it. My presentation would parallel closer to the first speakers today rather than the last 3. The wonderful layer cake structure of marriage. Not so much up and up close and personal, but rather a broad long-term structuring, both the continuity and changes in the history of Western civilization regarding marriage. And I hand you out a little handout that I haven't reformed for your use, but I use in congregations and at the seminary when I teach. And its basic structure talks about 5 models of marriage in Western civilization. And the most important researcher there is listed on the bottom, John Witte, who is professor of law and religion at Emory University and one of the foremost experts in the United States on this subject. People often use the phrase the sanctity of marriage. President Bush used it just last week in his State of the Union. It's a good phrase, but it has multiple meanings. In popular political usage, and I think probably this is the way the president used it last week, marriage's sanctity means set in stone for all times by nature and God. Means it's immutable and unchangeable, irreformable, perfect from the beginning. In theological ethics, the word sanctity means something quite different. It means that God is up to doing some good here and desires increasingly to do good through this particular institution of marriage. I give you the chart as a way to talk about 5 of the great models of marriage that have been operative in Western civilization. The first model is the model called marriage as sacrament. It's usually attributed to as the Roman Catholic model of marriage. The second model, social estate, marriage as social estate, is usually thought about to be the Lutheran contribution to the ethics of marriage. Marriage as covenant is more the Reformed tradition, the Calvinist Presbyterian in our country and others, Reformed tradition. Marriage as commonwealth is the Anglican tradition. The first speaker spoke a little bit about that. And the final one is marriage as contract, often thought to be the Enlightenment model of marriage. And I can't speak in the short time I have in very much detail about each one of these. But one of the things I wanted to talk about is the continuity and the change. In other words, there has been reform along with continuity in each one of these models and across the models. And the first model sets a lot of the precedents, and as was said earlier in the first presentation, it goes back at least until to Augustine, actually before him, to his teacher Ambrose and earlier people as well. It gets put into canon law in the 12th century, and therefore kind of gets put into a codified form, and then is talked about by Thomas Aquinas and others. My major, I have a couple of things to say about, in a certain sense, about the first speakers. I don't think that the first speaker said anything wrong. Only was a little one-sided in what he said. He tended to stress the continuity of marriage and look at, therefore, only the positives that the Western tradition of marriage or traditions of marriage have put forward. Those are, I would affirm most of those. But he overlooked the underside in all of the traditions that are listed here. And therefore the change and reform that's gone on for the better across the traditions. That would be the one thing that I'd like to say. And the second thing has to do with the nature of natural law. I'd be happy to come back to that perhaps if you have a question, since he talked about natural law. What I'd like to do is indulge you with a part of a couple of paragraphs. I read them from a book by Lisa Cahill, who's professor of moral theology at Boston University. She's a Roman Catholic feminist natural law theologian, moral theologian. Her book is called Sex, Gender, and Christian Ethics, published in 1997 by Cambridge University Press. And I use only this as one example of both the underside and the reform of law only within the marriage as sacrament model. She's talking about Augustine. And, of course, I'm taking out a couple of paragraphs or parts of a couple of paragraphs. You'd have to put it into her larger context, which affirms certain parts of Augustine, but also has this to say. Not only did Augustine stand at a historical point where Christian ambivalence towards sex and all the social roles which channeled it was practically unavoidable, his personal experience also positioned him perfectly to reflect and magnify the tension already expressed in the Christian differentiation of celibacy and marriage. In Augustine and in much of the early Christian tradition, celibacy was the ideal and marriage was a second-class way to be sanctified. Augustine invites biographical references in integrating his theology, for he himself ties personal history, religious experience, and theological insight closely together in his great book, The Confessions. While it would be excessive to read Augustine's central theological proposals in light of his sexual history, his own experiences of sex and his relationships with women, as he himself reports them, can legitimately be brought to bear on his ideas about sex and gender. Two women figured prominently in Augustine's life, his mother and the woman with whom he lived for 15 years and had a son. Skip to another paragraph. She talks then about this concubine. Augustine mentions his concubine wholly in terms of his own desires and responses, and of those he focuses on a sexual need so acute and unrelenting that it binds him, according to his own testimony, in a sort of slavery. By the way, this is before he becomes a Christian. It's an important point. Margaret Miles, she now quotes Margaret Miles, who professor, a Roman Catholic professor of moral theology and expert on Augustine at Yale Divinity School, even describes Augustine as a sex addict, although it is difficult to weigh his level of actual compulsiveness against his overwhelming revulsion in the face of sexual drives and reactions, especially in view of the fact that they represented to him a shameful lack of control. Sex was much aligned by the religious sect to which he belonged prior to becoming a Christian, called Manichaeism, to whose ideals he aspired. He once referred to the, quote, shame, this is a quote from Augustine, to the shameful motions of the organs of generation, and went on to opine that in Eden, sexual intercourse might fittingly have taken place without any sexual desire whatsoever, but rather by an act of sheer rationality. Although Augustine says, again a quote from Augustine, to love and be loved was sweet to me, still physical enjoyment of love turned friendship into, Augustine again, the hell of lustfulness. Even though he describes his heart as torn, wounded, and bleeding at separation from his lover, he still looks back on the relationship as making him a slave to lust. He remembers himself as enslaved with the disease of the flesh, captive to an insatiable lust. Well, we could go on. I say that only to say that there have been, some of this gets put into the tradition, of course, as far as what marriage has been all about, so that Augustine talked about marriage as a dike against sin, something that holds us back from sin, and therefore procreation is the only thing that makes sexuality at all moral, and even there it's rather tenuous about how moral sexuality can be, even when its primary purpose is for procreation. There would be a lot to talk about in that way. Martin Luther, early on, he was an Augustinian monk, talked about marriage in his first writing, before he was ever married and while he was still a priest, as a dike against sin. He later on, I think under the influence of his wife Katie, gave up that phrase and began to talk in a much more positive idea about marriage and sexuality and marriage as intimacy and some of the kinds of evolutions or reformations that other people have talked about. I'd welcome questions as we after I finish with this last section. We can pursue the kinds of questions. I understand you end in about 8 minutes or so.
You had about 3 minutes.
Oh, three.
Okay.
Well, regarding the layered bedrock slab on Mars that the Opportunity rover has found, Each roughly half-inch thick layer represents an event in the geographic history of the planet that opportunity should be able to reconstruct with its complement of cameras and scientific instruments. So goes the report in the paper. It's a useful analogy, I think, for the opportunity that lies before you all as legislators and us as citizens, the wonderful and weighty opportunity. I'm kind of jealous, and I urge you to invest yourself as fully to gain the critical moral knowledge and wisdom that is needed for the care and reform of marriage as our nation is investing in understanding Mars. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Simpson. Are there any questions for Professor Simpson? Seeing none.
Could I add one since I got 1 minute?
You bet.
Which is quite has a rigid and hierarchical view of human nature and of history. And in Aristotle's understanding of natural law, each part, whether it's the part of a body politic or each part of the body, has one and only one purpose and cannot have any other purposes. So, for instance, penises and vaginas have only one purpose or primary purpose, which is to produce children. The second thing for Aquinas that's important for classic natural law, there is also revisionist natural law, which Lisa Cahill and many other Roman Catholic theologians, moral theologians as well as myself, would argue for. And that's that the statistical mean is what is normative for Aristotle. So if there's a vast majority of people or a vast majority of certain class of people in one way, particularly oriented, if you talk about sexuality, oriented in one way, that becomes, that mean becomes the norm. In a critical revisionist notion of natural law, those principles are overturned. And there's a much greater chance of seeing a diversity, for instance, of sexual normativity across the spectrum of human beings. That would be only one thing to talk about.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Simpson. For the members or the public that testified today, we appreciate your preparation and your time. There will be a bill introduced on this subject. At the time that we have the actual bill hearing, there will be a different structure in a pro versus con related to a bill presented to the legislature. For committee members, we start on February 3rd. You are not getting a break. The first day we're going to be at it, we so far have four bills on the agenda. Unfortunately, leadership has a scheduling conflict on February 4th. There's some kind of program that's bioscience, something that we're all supposed to attend. So unfortunately, the taskmaster is only going to give you one real heavy committee schedule. On the 3rd, the 4th, we will not meet, and we will be meeting in room 10 this year. We have recaptured our room back from regulated industries.
You're here.
So with that, the meeting's adjourned, and we'll see you again on the 3rd. Thank you.